Get boogie down, down the home ground. The boogie down, down the home ground.
Randy Tobler, Truth Warrior, Woke Destroyer. On News Talk STL. Watch us on our live stream using Rumble, Facebook, and Twitter.
And I made it clear to Israelis, don't move on Haifa. It's just not, I mean, anyway, I just, look what we did recently when Israel was attacked.
Well, I was going to play that as just a funny soundbite because, of course, our hapless president told the Israelis a week or so ago not to move on Haifa. Well, they didn't move on Haifa the other night. They moved on Iran. At least that's what we think. They won't admit it. To help us understand what the heck happened this week with Israel responding to Iran's attack on Israel is former Senator Jim Talent, chairman of the Reagan Institute's National Leadership Council. And Jim, This was an interesting event the other night when I told my wife, my God, the market's tanking, oil prices spiking. Is my son-in-law going to be drafted for service? My other son-in-law who's in the service going to be deployed? And then it all evaporated by the next morning. Welcome to the program. Help us unpack what happened this week with Israel's attack on Iran.
Well, hey, Randy, good to be on with you. Well, we know what happened, I think, within limits. So Israel attacked the radar for Iran's S-300 air defense system in the facilities around Natanz, which is the locus for a lot of their nuke production. Okay, and the Israelis, although they haven't confirmed this and won't, I think they used a new system, a new missile, or new elements. And the point was to show the Iranians that they could destroy Iran's air defense systems. Because if you destroy their air defense systems, then you open up the whole country to the Israeli Air Force. So it was, they sent a message, and I've been thinking about it ever since they did it. I think it was a pretty brilliant stroke, both strategically and tactically. It restored deterrence, but it did it without the kind of comprehensive attack that would have been a substantial diversion of Israeli assets at a time when they're preparing to go into Rafah, not Haifa. Which is in Israel, you know, also we'll probably then move to push Hezbollah in the north beyond the Litani River so that the Israelis can resettle some of their northern villages where, you know, 80,000 people have had to evacuate. So that's what they did. What we don't know is the nature of the, whether it was a new missile or whatever, but I suspect that the Iranians were taken by surprise. And so it's, you know, it's a way of showing what you can do as a method of restoring deterrence.
Well, you know, there are some hard right wingers, I think one of whom is a member of the Israeli War Council, who is criticizing Israel and has caught a lot of flack from within Israel because he called the response lame. But on the other hand, as you said, when they have other bidding to do in behalf of their people in other venues, and in the same way, I think showing what deterrence really looks like, and I hope Joe Biden and friends are watching, they showed that when you, in that particular instance, as it relates to Iran specifically, seems to me it was one of those, hey, we're walking softly, but showing you what big stick we have. Whereas Joe Biden's tactic seemed to have been broadcast to the entire world that you are not going to use a big stick. In fact, you have a short stick and you won't even use that. I mean, it's a stark contrast in strategy and tactics, isn't it?
Yeah, a huge contrast, and I like your analogy. I think the idea of walking a little softly here, but showing the capabilities you have is a good way of putting it. No, I mean, it's complete different. A huge part of the problem in the Middle East right now is because Biden has continued Obama's policy of trying to structure an equilibrium in the Middle East around a partnership with Iran. It's probably, and this is saying a lot, the single stupidest thing I've seen in the 30 plus years I've been around Washington and foreign policy. Because Iran's interests, let me just take a moment, and I'll do this in a value-neutral way. Yes, the Iranian regime is terrible, but let's just look at how the regime defines its interests. So what Iran wants to do, Iran is a Persian Shia power. They want to overthrow the Sunni, somewhat more moderate regimes in the region, dominate the region, destroy Israel, and attack the United States at a minimum until the United States exits entirely from the Middle East. Now, that's obviously completely contradictory to our own interests in the region. And when you try and structure a partnership with a country that is clearly an adversary, I mean, it's not a partner. It will never be a partner. It's an adversary, okay? When you do that, then every time you try and operationalize that policy, you undermine your own position. So it's like you're in a boxing match with somebody and they're hitting you and you're hitting yourself. Every time you throw a punch, you're hitting yourself. And this is what Biden has done by unfreezing their assets, lifting sanctions or not enforcing them, ending weapons embargoes, one thing after another, he has empowered our enemy. And he has also convinced everybody in the region that we're crazy and therefore unreliable. And so it's difficult to get friends and potential friends to work with us. And this is literally what has happened. As you know, Randy, because I've been on the show periodically, I've been saying this for years because it's true. Now, a lot of what Donald Trump did was really, really brilliant in the region, like the Abraham Accords and taking out Qasem Soleimani. But basically, all Trump really did was get the common sense strategy right. Iran is the adversary. And if you just get that right, then a lot of really good things suggest themselves to you. If you get that wrong, you can send Anthony Blinken over there 100 times, and all you're going to do is dig the hole deeper on yourself. So that's the end of the read. You can ask another question now. But
I get it.
But, I mean,
yeah. Well, let me ask you this.
People, that the hard thing is to convince people that anybody could do anything that dumb. You know, because they're, and I understand it. You know, they're saying, well, it can't be that stupid. Yep, it's that stupid.
Well, let me ask you this. Okay, so you mentioned the Abraham Accords, and it appeared as though while the other Arab nations that were party to that may not be Israel's BFF, it sort of seemed like a neighborhood watch to me. Everyone or most people in the region, most regimes in the region, recognizing that Iran's hegemony is not good for any of them collectively, just in terms of their entire security of the whole region. Is some of that coalition eroding as a result of Israel's aggressive attack, which, of course, I think we all realize is a necessity to once and for all eliminate Hamas? But is some of that eroding, or is that still holding strong? What's going on with that? The remnants of the Abraham Accord as Israel continues to fight on in Gaza and gets bad press and misinformation and misrepresentation of the civilian deaths and on and on and on.
Well, I would say it's been a sort of one step forward, one step back since Trump left. Because Biden then went on also, and you can see why in other words, if you understand what I just said, if people, then you understand why, for example, Biden deliberately alienated the Saudis because he wants a partnership with Iran, right? So the Saudis, of course, responded to that by opening up discussions with Iran. In other words, they said, okay, you know what? If you're not going to help us constrain Iran, we'll cut our own deal. So did the UAE. So that was all negative. On the other hand, what we saw the other day when Iran launched its missiles was that the Saudis and the Jordanians openly, visibly, which is what was really great about it, helped us and helped CENTCOM shoot down the missiles. So I would say that the strength of the logic behind the Trump policy is so powerful that it has survived even Biden's tenure here, and it can be picked up again, okay? But it's not really going to go anywhere until either the Biden administration has an epiphany and decides, well, maybe Iran really is the adversary, or until we elect somebody new.
Okay. Well, let's now, in that context, having brilliantly illustrated what's going on over there strategically and tactically in the Middle East, our domestic arguments, and you know many, Jim, many of the people listening to this program are absolutely against any kind of foreign aid, whether it be to Ukraine, but specifically in this case, Israel or anyone else, until we get our border secure. They're up in arms, and an increasing number of Republicans in the House, and you were a House member before you were a senator, are up in arms saying, Mike Johnson, what's wrong with you? How come you won't secure our border before you're sending money to help, secure Israel's sovereignty and Ukraine and on and on and on? What do you make of the circus going on in the House as it relates to our foreign policy, specifically about the Middle East and aid to Israel?
Yeah, well, let me address that. And I think the instinct behind that impulse, that we need to look out for America first. In other words, again, on the highest levels is the strategic level. And so the instinct that all our foreign policy, and in fact, domestic policy as well, ought to be to advance the interests of the people of the United States is absolutely correct. Now, the question with regard to foreign aid, and I had these issues when I was in office. I had many very fruitful discussions with constituents. And what I always said was, I support foreign aid when it advances the security and interests of the American people. And so, for example, giving money to UNRWA, the UN agency responsible or supposedly responsible for helping the Palestinians, not only doesn't advance our interests, it hurts our interests. We ought not to do it, okay? However, in this case, supporting Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan advances the interests of the United States. For the same reason, basically, it's the same logic I used before. The adversary of our adversary is our friend. And the most controversial, you know, in my party is the Ukraine aid. And if the issue in Ukraine were a localized dispute between Russia and Ukraine, then I would tend to agree. We just stay out of it. That's what India's done. That's a rabbit hole I'm not going to go down. But from their perspective, that makes sense. But the problem is that Russia under Putin has, and quite deliberately, made itself our adversary, not just in Eastern Europe, but in the Middle East, and most importantly, in the Indo-Pacific. He and Xi Jinping declared a treaty of unlimited friendship, and he is helping China. So weakening our adversary helps us. And if you look at it from that perspective, I mean, really the question is, well, why shouldn't we help the Ukrainians? Because they are weakening the ability of the Russian state to hurt us in other places. Now, I agree. In fact, I wrote a column about this about a year and a half ago that we should not finance a stalemated battlefield in Ukraine indefinitely. It's not in our interests. Okay. There should be an exit strategy. Unfortunately, we can't get one because we have an administration that, you know, it's not as bad as what they've done in the Middle East. But they're not focused on an outcome that benefits the United States. They're not explaining, okay, what is the end stage? But I don't think we can allow Ukraine to lose because that would help Putin. And again, it would undermine our reputation, letting another ally go down. Mm-hmm. That's not good. Mm-hmm. So I think we've got to sustain the Ukrainians until we get a new administration. And I think if we do, I kind of believe Trump when he says he thinks he can end the war very quickly. It's just a question of getting Putin to the table under circumstances where Putin has an incentive to negotiate a reasonable settlement. And I have a fair amount of faith that Trump can do that. But I think in the meantime, we do not. And the Ukrainians are, I mean, that won't be easy, but I think it can be done. In the meantime, the Ukrainians have problems now. I mean, we could go into that if you want, but I am concerned that if we don't provide them the basic enablers they need, you know, the artillery shells, the javelins, that sort of thing, that they could lose this war in the next year. And if you had a cup of coffee with Donald Trump, he would tell you I don't want that to happen. That would just make my life more difficult, which is true.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's sustain Ukraine until we get an administration that has an intelligent idea about how we're going to end this thing. And the rest of the aid, I think the party's united about. I think just about everybody wants to support Israel. They want to support Taiwan. In terms of border security, I'd love it if the Congress could pass and get signed into law measures to enforce the border, even though it's not necessary. What we need there is a new president. I mean, let's just say it. And in the meantime, I don't know what can be done. I certainly don't blame Johnson for not getting that done. We just don't have.
Okay.
We have somebody in a position who's supposed to enforce the law who's not enforcing the law. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. And we have Schumer, who won't even have a discussion in a trial sense. Well, Jim, as always, I appreciate it, and we never have enough time. I hope as things continue to unfold and the boiling and the turbulence goes on over there, that you can help with your wisdom and your experience in this is just invaluable to the audience. And I thank you for sharing it with us. Really do. Appreciate it.
Glad to do it, Randy. Just shoot me a text and... We'll okay. do it again.
We'll do that. Thanks, Jim. Have a great weekend. There he is, former Senator Jim Talent, and as the chair of the Reagan Leadership Council, and being in touch with, of course, and always channeling the brilliance of Ronald Reagan's policies. I think that's what I'm continuing to hear. When Reagan was asked, what do you do when you think about foreign policy? I think it was always something like, America wins. And that's what I'm hearing Jim say. America wins. Hey, we'll be back and talk about babies winning, babies who shouldn't be aborted. And there's a movement to try to fight back against this initiative petition that would like to wipe out babies in America, in Missouri. We'll come back and talk with Dr. Bob Onder just after a few words. Stay tuned.
And when you try and structure a partnership with a country that is clearly an adversary, then every time you try and operationalize that policy, you undermine your own positions. It's like you're in a boxing match with somebody and they're hitting you and you're hitting yourself.
Randy Tobler, Truth Warrior, Woke Destroyer on News Talk STL. Watch us on our live stream using Rumble, Facebook, and Twitter. This is News Talk STL.
Well, you know, one of the most important issues of our time is protecting the unborn. And it's been probably the hot button issue since the Dobbs decision came down a couple years ago. And to help us now discuss what's been going on in Missouri, specifically regarding that initiative petition issue and whether we will be able to do anything to protect the unborn. It's good to talk with Dr. Bob Onder, who's, of course, a former state senator and congressional candidate for Blaine Lukemire's seat. And Bob, welcome to the program as the guy who really was driving most, if not all, of the protection of the unborn in Missouri. You got to feel a lot of heartburn over what's going on and the potential threat to the unborn if this initiative petition passes.
Well, good morning, Randy. Yeah, it's great to be back. Indeed, I do. It has been a 50-year fight to protect innocent human life in the state of Missouri and around the country. And, you know, we're coming down to the wire where this radical initiative petition that through Missouri's, you know, IP process, where out-of-state progressive billionaires can come to Missouri and spend, you know, a few million dollars and buy themselves an amendment to our Constitution. Those forces are down to fewer than 3 weeks to collect the signatures to get that that really destructive measure on the ballot. And so, you know, so what prompted, you know, a text I sent to you the other day is the Post-Dispatch is going all in trying to help the pro-abortion forces and trying to counter the decline to sign effort by Missouri Right to Life and others. And, you know, said, I think, some, you know, very, very fallacious things about the pro-life efforts and the decline to sign effort.
Right. And so I got ahead of us, assuming that they're going to get their signatures. And that's really what the debate is about. They need to accumulate what they need to have 170,000, roughly 172,000 signatures that have to be approved, which means they have to get more than that because some are thrown out. But there is this decline to sign movement. And Bob, I've told the story on more than one radio show that I have been approached to sign this initiative petition by not one, but two people who have misrepresented what's in this petition, this constitutional amendment, as, oh, we're just restoring Roe. We're just restoring Roe. Well, that's not the case, right? Let's discuss what really happens if this constitutional amendment passes and why people should decline to sign.
Yeah, that is 100% correct, Randy. Over the years, you and I have discussed, is there some sort of middle ground between Roe versus Wade and, you know, and completely outlawing abortion? It's very clear that's not what this initiative petition is about. Roe versus Wade at least allowed health and safety regulation. It allowed licensing requirements where only physicians can do abortions. It allowed parental notification and consent laws. And Roe versus Wade allowed bans on barbaric practices like partial birth abortion. This initiative petition is extremely radical. It very explicitly says that any, quote, denial, interference, delay, or restriction of abortion is, quote, presumed invalid. So what are those things that I mentioned, like health and safety regulations, informed consent requirements, and so on? What are they other than restrictions? And we know the pro-abortion left hates these kind of health and safety regulations and restrictions. In fact, they call them, quote, trap laws, target regulation of abortion providers. The second this initiative petition would pass and be in our Constitution, ACLU lawyers, narrow lawyers, Planned Parenthood lawyers would be in court to strike down every one of Missouri's protections of the health and safety of women and of innocent human life.
And you know what's disturbing is the way the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I like to call them the St. Louis Most Attached, the way they portrayed and they basically denied the truth of the ambiguities and the broad openings that are given to things that the Missouri Right to Life and other coalitions are saying, hey, wait a minute. Like you said, at this point, as I understand it, look, let's talk about one of them. They allow basically pretty much anyone to assist in an abortion, right? You don't even have to be a physician. It pretty much opened the floodgates. And when and the Post-Dispatch tried to dismiss that objection one after another.
One after another, Randy. And the thing is, the law here has to be, it's a general principle that in a contract, any vague ambiguities are construed against the drafter. They didn't leave anything vague here. They just said any regulation of abortion, if you read line by line, every regulation of abortion is going to be presumed invalid. In another example I didn't mention yet is in paragraph 6, essentially that any restriction on public funding or government assistance of abortion is presumed invalid. You know, from the early days after Roe versus Wade, about 1975, I believe it was, the Hyde Amendment represented a consensus of Republicans and Democrats that although abortion was legal post-Roe, at least taxpayers shouldn't be forced to fund abortion, that would go out the window and your listeners would be forced to fund abortion through their tax dollars. So there is nothing middle of the road, nothing moderate, and certainly this isn't just a restoration of Roe. This is the most radical pro-abortion law, constitutional amendment that could be written, and that's exactly what they're gathering signatures for right now.
Yeah. Now, let's look at another provision in this amendment, which the Missouri Right to Life and my co-host in my other show, Stephanie Bell with Missouri Stands with Women, both of whom are in trying to advance this, declined to sign. They point out that while you and I mean, you're an attorney, you're also a doc, I'm a doc, yes. You know, the trial lawyers and medical malpractice, they're no friends of ours, you know, but no, but that said, you and I were both in training at Washington University when they would bring in a Kansas so-called doctor, and I use that term loosely, to come in and do late-term abortions down the street on Euclid Avenue, just down the street from Barnes and Jewish hospitals. And when there was a botched late term abortion where they went in and they have to crunch the baby's bones, I make it very graphic for a purpose because it needs to be made graphic. Yes. Those bones could damage the woman's uterus, could result in bleeding and sepsis and near death. They would drop the patient off at the door, and we would be left trying to keep that patient alive. I was involved in some of those cases. Those botched abortion claims would no longer be valid under this amendment, as I understand it. Now, you're the attorney. I'm not. Am I right on this? And is Missouri Stands with Women right? Or is the Post-Dispatch right?
Yeah, no, I think that is right, because in the law, or in paragraph 5 of the amendment, the proposed constitutional amendment, it talks about no person shall be penalized, prosecuted, or otherwise subjected to adverse action based on their actual potential perceived or alleged pregnancy outcomes, including but not limited to, and they list a bunch of things. You know, if they had stopped with prosecution, okay, fine, you know, abortion's legal now, you can't prosecute anyone for doing an abortion, but they talked about adverse action and so on. Well, you know, if you know anyone who's been involved in a malpractice lawsuit, it's an adverse action against you based on, quote, pregnancy outcomes. The whole point of this amendment is to draft everything as vaguely and broadly as possible, so that they can, so that they can really strike down all of our pro-life laws. But in this case, I think you're right. Strike down that right to seek recourse for medical malpractice damages in the civil justice system. I think that is right. You know, Randy.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Yeah, please. Randy, and since we have two physicians on the phone this morning, I want to say that one of the biggest lies that are being told on the sidewalk in front of the Walmart is this, the idea that somehow this amendment is needed so that women can get good care of their health in the case of a miscarriage. Randy, you and I know that for decades, centuries, pro-life OBGYNs and other doctors have given good care to women who have had miscarriages. Doctors like the one I'm talking to, who would never do an abortion, you know, take good care of women. The idea that this radical pro-abortion amendment is necessary to ensure a woman's right to care of her miscarriage is just a lie.
Yeah, that's a total mischaracterization, and frankly, it's an insult to good doctors, especially pro-life doctors, who absolutely are at all times looking out for the health and welfare of a woman, and would in no way, shape, or form compromise care and somehow threaten the health of a woman because of the management of a miscarriage or a tubal pregnancy. And, you know, I could go on and on for hours.
Exactly.
But look, I don't know where they are in their drive, but they're certainly well-funded. And as you said, the drive to obtain these signatures, and in fact, the very notion and drive for this amendment is like in Kansas and Ohio and others, it's funded from outside the state.
Well, it is. It's funded outside. You know, the formula is, you know, and if you go on my social media feed, you'll find lots of people saying things like, oh, just let the people vote. Don't you trust the people? Well, when the people are lied to, not only by the, you know, multi tens of million dollar pro-abortion effort that we'll see if this if they get the signatures. But they're actually being lied to by the text of the ballot initiative itself. So, probably 90% of the money comes from out of state. We really are talking about out of state left-wing pro-abortion billionaires coming in to our state to buy an amendment to our Constitution. And 50 years of very carefully considered, very carefully drafted law, you know, written by the Missouri House, the Missouri Senate, by your elected officials, signed by your governor, sometimes vetoed by the governor and overridden by the legislature. All of that 50 efforts to protect the health and safety of women, to protect the unborn, that'll be thrown out the window by this out of state special interest money.
Talking with Dr. Bob Onder at Bob Onder Mo on X, formerly Twitter, who's of course candidate for Missouri Congressional District 3 and a staunch advocate for our constitutional values along the way, both here in the state and you know, Bob, I got to tell you, I just want to know here if I can get your opinion. I know that it's breaking yesterday. It was a Friday night dump. The assault on women and women's equality and women's rights and the rights of young women to compete against women and not men masquerading as women, not having to shower with men masquerading as women. Your thoughts on that assault by the Biden administration on Title IX?
Oh, yeah, this is ridiculous. It is a truly perverse interpretation of Title IX that a law that was passed to protect women's sports is now being used to decimate, to destroy women's sports. Your best high school track athletes, boys, can beat the world champion women in that same sport. Women's sports are over if the Biden administration has its way and if Biden is reelected in November. But even worse yet, the danger to the safety and the privacy of women when boys and men pretending to be women can go into women's restrooms, locker rooms, shower rooms is just appalling. It's perverse. I cannot see how anyone with a daughter, no matter how progressive, could support this garbage. And it's just pathetic, and it's just a further effort evidence of the undermining of our culture and our society and decency by the far left. Yeah.
Well, I know there's been moves in the Congress, and I just wonder how important this is in your run, and you know, as a plank in your platform positions, your policy positions. There's a move in Congress, and it's never really gotten a lot of momentum. But there's been bill after bill, you know, addressing the issue of an over aggressive bureaucratic state and some reining in to where when a statute's passed and then rules are made that the Congress should have final say on whether those rules comport with the statute. Is there any hope of that ever seeing the light of day in a future Congress Oval Office president?
I think that absolutely needs to be done. I think it should be done in the law, in statute. But I think there's a very good chance that thanks to Donald Trump appointees on the U.S. Supreme Court, that the so-called Chevron doctrine will be overturned. The Chevron doctrine just holds that if there's any ambiguity in the statute, courts should always defer to the so-called experts, the bureaucrats and the federal agencies. And that's just bad law, because we know those federal agencies and bureaucrats have no sense of restraint. They're not restrained by voters. They're not restrained, by the rule of law. And the Chevron doctrine says they can't even be restrained by judges and courts. So, yeah, that absolutely needs to be overturned judicially, but it will be a major focus of my service in Congress to rein in the bureaucratic state, the deep state, the swamp.
All right, Bob, other than Twitter, at Bob Onder Mo, where can people learn more about your run for Congress, your policy positions?
Yeah, my website is bobondermo.com and Facebook is Bob Ondermo.
All right. Hey, thanks, man. I really appreciate you being on with me. All the best thanks, this Randy. Weekend and going weekend. Forward. We'll see you.
Thank you very much.
All right. There he is, Dr. Bob Onder. Boy, I tell you, this initiative petition, if they ask you to sign it, tell them no and tell friends of yours that are having the wool pulls over their eyes and this initiative petition been misrepresented. Please have them strongly consider not signing as well. When we come back, your calls welcome. 314-912-1019. That's the number here on News Talk STL 101.9 94.1 as we wrap it up on the Tobler Show.
There's nothing middle of the road, nothing moderate, and certainly this isn't just a restoration of Roe. This is the most radical pro-abortion law constitutional amendment that could be written, and that's exactly what they're gathering signatures for right now.
That we're back on Facebook, so that's good. Somehow we got that straightened out. If you had to switch over to Rumble or YouTube or Twitter, we're back on Facebook now. So if you'd like to catch the end of the show, that'd be great. It's been a good one. If you missed it, Jerome will have it up on the Spotify podcast platform later on today. Joining us now on the phone is Jeremy. How you doing, Jeremy? Thanks for joining the Tobler Show.
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. What's going on?
I wanted to bring up another issue with the petition that those on the right aren't really paying attention to, because we don't really pay attention enough to what the left does with language. And I've been in pro-life ministry for almost 20 years, and I've watched over the last few years as the left has transitioned, and that's a pun, from the term women's healthcare over to this term reproductive health. And if you look at that petition, they use the term reproductive health or reproductive freedom, I think 7 times this word would be put into our Constitution, and it's not defined. But if you look at what the left is doing with that word, those words, they're including anything having to do with reproductive organs in the term reproductive health. You can go do a search on Google for reproductive health, gender transitions, and you're going to find that the Boston Children's Medical Hospital, University of Chicago Med, they are doing gender transitions, hormone therapy, hysterectomies, gender-affirming hysterectomies, under the term reproductive health. So all of the concerns that Dr. Onder just laid out with abortion also apply to gender transition. If this gets in our Constitution, schools will be allowed to gender transition children without telling their parents. This is a much bigger deal than just abortion.
Wow. I hadn't thought about that. I thought you were going to go down the how can abortion be reproductive by its very essence of the definition of the word, that is not reproductive, that is destructive behavior.
Correct.
But you're right.
The word gender transition.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Hey, I didn't think about that as far as the broad application of the term reproductive health. Thanks for bringing that to my to our attention. I am going to now include that in my cascade of objections to the initiative petition. All right. Hey, thanks a lot, Jeremy, and thank you for your work in behalf of the unborn. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Next on the line is John. I think it's John the first. How you doing, John? Oh, thanks for weighing in this morning. What's on your mind?
Well, hey, and I apologize. I started listening about 8:30. Did you guys talk about the trial for Trump that started on Monday?
Yeah, we did talk about it earlier with Zach Smith at 6:25, actually.
Gotcha. I was still sleeping, Randy.
Yeah, that's so, okay. We'll forgive you, but you can listen to the podcast. So that's okay.
What's your thought of... So I don't think it's going so well for Mr. Trump. You know, obviously showing his age by falling asleep, dirty diaper Don is, sitting there filling his Depends and falls asleep and falls back in it. And then yesterday, you had basically a human sacrifice or burnt offerings to a false god there in Donald Trump. And it's not covered very much on Fox News or Newsmax. I mean, they cover some of it, but they didn't cover...
I understand from attorney friends of mine that there's nothing more boring than jury selection. I mean, it is the most boring aspect. And Trump has bigger fish to fry. And after all, the DOJ, with its weaponization of our legal system and unprecedented application of statutes that have never been used but could have been in other applications, they're taking him off the campaign trail. So I think he's just resting up so he can go and campaign in the few hours that he has left. You saw him go to the bodega and get lots of accolades when he went to the bodega, where the man defending himself stabbed some perpetrator to death, which is appropriate. That should have happened. And then Alvin Bragg, tried to prosecute him. Go ahead.
And the crowd, that pre-planned crowd that was there, were full of young Republicans.
Yeah, well, there's never pre-planned crowds with Ilhan Omar or AOC either, right? There's never pre-planned crowds with them.
I mean, I don't follow those two people, so I don't.
Yeah, well, that's good. All right. Hey, listen, I want to play for you something. You talked about Dirty Diaper Don? Okay, take a listen to a clip here that Joe Biden, in a speech the other day, Joe Biden said something that really had me scratching my head. Maybe you, because you are the arbiter of all things wise and good, John the First. Maybe you can translate this Biden gaffe, as far as I'm saying. Maybe translate this for us. Take a listen.
And my uncle, they called him.
No. Jerome, please play number 7. Number 7, the Biden bite.
Are you ready to choose freedom over democracy? Because that's America.
Yeah. Okay. Are you ready to choose freedom over democracy? Because that's America. Can you explain to me, A, what Biden was saying? We need a little Biden translation. And why did the audience applaud, John? I'm going to give you the last word.
Good question there. Let's see. Choose freedom over democracy. Would that be what Republicans call democracy? Or
No. Don't deflect. Don't deflect. Why did... No, don't deflect. We all know what democracy is.
We're talking about the definition of democracy. What is it?
No. We're talking about freedom over democracy. What in the world? That Joe Biden wasn't speaking for Republicans. It was Joe Biden speaking. So what was he saying?
He speaks for all America.
He does.
America's president. Oh. Is he not?
Okay, so we're going to choose freedom over democracy. That means Joe Biden is threatening democracy because he's choosing freedom over democracy. And he claims that Trump is a threat to democracy. Explain that.
Well, Trump is a threat to democracy. He said he wanted to be a dictator on day one.
You're mischaracterizing the context. Come on, you're better than that, St. John. He was talking about going to dictate a closure of the border, just like Biden did. Hey, I got to run, but thank you for the call. I always enjoy it. You always wait till the last minute. Hey, thank you very much. I really do appreciate you calling, seriously. Hey, we had a really barn burner of a show. We thank you for joining us, however you could join us and whenever you could join us. Make sure you catch the podcast and stay tuned to all the great programming today and every day on Newstalk STL. Remember, faith, family, freedom, those are the key principles to restoring this America to the greatest country this planet has ever seen. We'll see you next week.